I'm Dr. Megan Corrado, and welcome to Real Stories, a podcast that features the narratives of trauma survivors, professionals, and community leaders. Real Stories provides a platform for guests with diverse life experiences to voice and honor their unique narratives. During today's episode, we will be speaking with Dr. Lyndra Bills. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, you're welcome. I'm really happy to join you today, and thanks for having me.
So let's start off by you telling us about who you are.
Okay, so I am a psychiatrist and an internist. That's my background training-wise, and I spent some extra time focusing on post-traumatic stress and traumatic stress in my training at WVU. And I work in Pennsylvania. I work now for Community Care Behavioral Health as a senior medical director, but I've done a lot of different things in psychiatry and in the mental health field and other things besides that as well.
Can you tell us a little more about what you do? You mentioned briefly, kind of from a bird's eye view, what you do, but is there anything else you want to mention specifically about what you do?
Yes, I appreciate that. I would want to also add that I really have an interest in the traumatic stress field, and I have for a long time, especially since the earlier years of my training. But I was fortunate to have a lot of influence by some great teachers and mentors, and I developed a trauma method to help folks with resolving some symptoms from PTSD, called trauma art narrative therapy. So I feel positive about that.
How long has trauma art narrative therapy been around?
Well, I really kind of formalized it 1993, 1994.
Okay. And you've been doing trainings all over the country, right?
Right. I've done trainings all over the country and then some in other countries, Mexico, the UK, South America as well.
Can you share with us a little bit about what got your intervention started?
Well, it would go back to my training years. And the main thing was that, actually, I would say my training years and just basically how I was brought up. People have asked me this question before, and I've thought about it. I was raised as a ranch girl, as a cowgirl, and as part of that upbringing, I spent a lot of time with doing work with animals and livestock, where you could spend most of the time in a day and really not speak to the other person. Everybody's working, paying attention to what's going on with nature and animals. And I think that's where my interest in the nonverbal mind or the more creative side of human nature developed back then. And then when I was in my training, I had the fortune to be exposed to a lot of creative arts in my training. And people who really thought, mentors especially, that thought the creative arts and nonverbal approaches were really important to be able to help people heal.
It's really interesting because a lot of interventions today focus on words. And it's really amazing to hear about how your intervention is trying to support people in expressing their thoughts, their feelings about trauma without necessarily using language.
I think that's so important because one of the things that's so basic for understanding what happens when somebody's exposed to some horrific stressor or some trauma is that it's so common that they'll lose the words. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and we understand that better than we ever have. But in practical ways, people have to express it in some other way, and then add the words back.
It's really ironic to me how we know that people who've experienced trauma don't necessarily have access to the language to be able to describe their experiences. But we almost, in a lot of treatment protocols, we almost expect them to have the language in order for us to use the intervention with them.
I know. I feel like that's pretty unfair, to be honest. And kind of everything about, like, certainly in my world of, you know, like a medical model, you know, as a physician to practice, you're everything is designed to expect people to, you know, tell me what happened, tell me this, tell me that. And, mm-hmm. all, you know, all the buttons, we, you know, now it's all computerized. So you click this, click that, and you're just asking a ton of questions for the person that you expect them to respond. And I liked when I'm teaching the trauma art narrative therapy, I like to try to remind people, you know, a person, if you ask them a question, really, they're going to try their best to answer it, even if they may have trouble answering it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to try to. So I think if you're tuned into the idea that the nonverbal mind is ever present and that somebody won't always have the words for a really bad thing that happened, it's okay if you ask them a question, okay, but recognize that you probably didn't get the whole story.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's a really profound statement, that we might not necessarily get the whole story just in words.
Right.
So we know that every individual, every community, every system has a story, and every story includes both adversity and strength. Can you talk to us about some of the adversities that you faced?
Well, I think I can think of several that, you know, so professionally and personally. So some of the things professionally had to do with, I think, I would say mostly around challenges to being able to be creative. Let's put it that way. Like how important it is, you know, like I said earlier, I had some fantastic mentors and colleagues, you know, that really supported me to be able to be creative and, you know, push that envelope and do whatever, you know, kind of whatever I needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, unfortunately, as you're probably aware, a lot of people are aware, that's not always the case. So when you kind of run up against a kind of wall, some of my adversity professionally was, for instance, when I left my residency training, one of my earliest jobs was in a state hospital system, and certainly plenty of need. And I felt adequately prepared to face that challenge, so to speak. And but I also was really struck by how much there was just this stuckness of the leadership and the system not wanting to make things a lot better.
Mm.
And that just really hit me hard. Like, that was a moral hit. I think once I always tell people, I'm kind of like glass half full type person. So I'm sort of always looking in the best view, and a lot of times not seeing what's the reality. Sometimes it's pretty horrible. So I think one of my earlier lessons was facing the reality that, gosh, there are ways to help people, and we have a lot of knowledge now to be able to help people in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of opportunities. There's so many things, like when you were talking about all the different modalities we have to help people, whether they can use words or not. I mean, there's a ton of things.
Right.
So sometimes I think the systems are not as flexible as they need to be to allow that to happen. And I, earlier in my career, I took that really hard, almost, you know, to the point that it certainly made me really feel terrible, kind of, you know, how can I help this? When I knew you could make a difference, you know, if you educated people, you could make a difference. People could certainly do better. So those were some kind of early things. And that, I've seen that repeatedly, and you know, systems are tough that way. They change slowly. You have to be more patient. And by nature, I'm not a patient person, so that was a handicap earlier. So that's an example of type of adversity, really. And then personally, I certainly grew up, like I had mentioned earlier, I grew up in a ranching farm family. and plenty of family conflicts and a lot of things that would be a good predictor for why I ended up in the field of psychiatry in the first place. Within my family. So family members with just some pretty tough, you know, they weren't able to handle their aggression and they could be pretty violent. So seeing a lot of the way people would interact in a violent way and, you know, that kind of experience certainly did impact me as well. I think that's good to, you know, I recognize that and appreciate how that's influenced the direction and the path I've taken and helps me be, you know, certainly more understanding.
Mm. Can you share a few positive moments or turning points in your story?
Yes. I'll tell you. So I was thinking about this related to using the creative arts. I can remember really pretty clearly where I kind of realized, gosh, that those creative arts are so critical to helping somebody make progress or improve. And one of my earliest memories was in my training experience. So I like to tell people that we were fortunate. We had an art therapist, and in that institution, on the inpatient side, every person who was admitted, that could be kids, adolescents, adults, everybody was given an art therapy assessment. They had to draw a picture of a person picking an apple off a tree. And that was kind of the standard drawing, and they used a certain size of paper. And I don't know if they had to use specific, pencils or crayons or whatever, but nevertheless, they had that. And the art therapist went around and collected all those. And actually, that art therapist and his mentor, she was an art therapist, pretty well-known art therapist, Linda Gant. And they developed a scale to assess that drawing. Okay. Mm. So then we did that. And then I remember, so I'm giving you that background. And then I remember one time I was working on the inpatient side, and we did do all the, you know, latest kind of interventions of psychiatry at the times, including ECT. And I remember being in a rounds meeting, and the art therapist was in our rounds, and we had the head psychiatrist, all the different students, you know, of all kinds, social worker and psychologist, just a whole group, nursing. And I remember the art therapist raised his hand to talk about a particular person that was getting ECT and how they were doing. Mm-hmm. We were reviewing it, and he held up the drawings so he would do the baseline drawing, and then he would do that same drawing, especially for everybody getting ECT in between all of their treatments.
Okay.
So he followed the progress, and he goes, I think you better stop doing the ECT because look at these drawings. I'll show you how the person is starting to decline a little bit. Mm-hmm. The ECT is probably making them a little bit worse. So you need to stop. And the attending psychiatrist she said, oh, wow, that's really helpful. And okay. So she told the nurse, like, no more ECT, we're stopping. And I thought, you know, that influenced me so greatly because I thought, gosh, you know, so I left that meeting, and then certainly I had many experiences like that. But in my training, I took the role of the creative arts as important as if I prescribed a pill, no different.
Mm.
So that's kind of like, for me, they were equally valid interventions. I mean, I don't know how you could really compare them, but if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting when we think about the medical model and when we think about treatment and we think about systems and managed care and their attitude toward the arts today. It just stands in such stark contrast to what you're mentioning, saying that the arts are just as valuable as some of the psychopharmaceutical interventions that a psychiatrist might prescribe.
I know. So that was one of my, like, a harsh reality. This is what I would call it. You know, when I left, you know, like, university training and was out in the quote unquote real world. And so I realized, oh my gosh, you know, it was really an effort to get those creative arts for people. Fortunately, I did work with the Dr. Bloom and the Sanctuary group, and I joined them. And mm-hmm. they also, we had a lot of similar viewpoints on the importance of the creative arts, and Dr. Bloom recognized that as well. So did her whole team. And so we had the fortune of having, like, you know, we had art therapy, we had movement therapy, we had psychodrama, all the above. And that's really, that was really unusual. Even years ago, that was unusual to have all that.
It sounds like the utopia of treatment.
It was awesome. And you know, for us, like, I mean, I have to say, like, you know, that just seemed very normal, like, that you would have all those options. I brought the trauma art narrative therapy to the mix, and we added other things, like myself, I trained in EMDR, so that could be an option. And then certainly we had all the kind of more standard psychodynamic psychotherapies too, not excluding any of those things. But we knew that for any one person, you couldn't guarantee which modality was going to work the best.
Right. So you offered them multiple different options so that they had different things to choose from.
Yeah. That worked the best.
Any other positive moments or turning points that you want to highlight?
I think I also had some really great exposure to social psychiatry, which, you know, you don't often hear that much about it. But earlier in my school, in med school especially, but I was got exposed early on to social psychiatry and kind of the idea, the importance of understanding how people relate in groups. And I had a lot of great experiences with that, and as a student, and was able to be, you know, again, a lot of freedom for creativity. Those were all positive, and I've had many positive experiences doing my trauma art narrative therapy, doing the training, and you know, learning from people as they try things and use things. Those are all really positive. So I feel positive about all the resources out there.
Mm. Where do you see yourself in the future? What's your future vision?
Well, my future vision is professionally to continue emphasizing the importance of options with traumatic stress treatment. I certainly try to do that in my current job, and then I like to emphasize that with the trauma art narrative therapy training as well. But I really think it's important to continue to educate people about how you need, you know, you need the verbal, but you really need the nonverbal. So trying to continue to focus that on that. And I also think it's really important to keep bringing people back to the body side. That was the other part of my training background. I mean, I got really interested in trauma really related to the body effects I saw. So I saw a lot of body, the impact of trauma on the body. And I saw that growing up as well. And then I saw it in my training. So that made me really interested in how, again, that nonverbal world could come out very literally with a body symptom or a specific pain somewhere in the body that somebody was struggling with. And it really would be related to their trauma. So that's, like, for me professionally, that's been another way that I've really been attracted to trying to help people, because that's a really challenging area of the traumatic stress world.
Right. And then that also feeds into the difficulty verbalizing trauma memories too, how some of our trauma memories are, like, so deeply rooted in the body that they're also difficult for us to express with words.
That's right. So I think, again, you really have to have the nonverbal means. But besides that, you have to actually have people that take it seriously. Mm-hmm. I think on the professional side or the caregiver side, the healers, have to really believe that that's possible. That's how somebody can express their trauma. And because for the person who has that problem, or maybe it's not really, that's problem's not the best word, but the person who's having the challenge of expressing themselves, and this is just where they are, if they're in that state and nobody's really taken that seriously, that makes it doubly hard or more.
Right, right. And then it also requires the therapist or the clinician to be confident in their own skills, in their own ability, and in the client's expertise over their own experiences, because it can feel very anxiety provoking to be working with someone on trauma without any words.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that's one of the things I try to do with my training is I try to validate that's a reality, and it's pretty hard, you know, especially people maybe earlier in their career, but not just earlier in their career, at any point they can really be kind of really uncomfortable with that space of the nonverbal world and what might come out. And once people get used to it, I think it's not so bad, but I really feel like part of the reason why that's even a problem is people aren't exposed to it in school.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. The more they can be exposed to it in school, the less that would be an issue.
Right. I think too, as I'm thinking about some of the very enthusiastic, excited master's students that I have educated in social work, they're really excited to be able to use all these different tricks and strategies. But then it's more uncomfortable for them to be able to sit with the silence and to recognize that even when no words are being spoken, all types of things are still being communicated to them in the session.
Right. Yeah, I think that thing about silence is really tough on people, on clinicians. I think that's really hard. I mean, I have a little bit of a smirk on my face, which is not very nice, but I know that's true, and I think that's a skill to develop. So, like mm-hmm. you know, when I was saying earlier, like I spent what's the image in my mind is that I spent hours. Hours on horseback, actually, even when I was as little as 6 years old, with one uncle in particular, who we could be out on horseback, even when I was that little, for, you know, 5-6 hours in a day, easy.
Mm.
And maybe one or two words spoken the whole time.
Wow. Even at 6 years old.
Oh yeah. At 6 years old, because that's just was the way he was. And he was all about work, and there was work to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really talk. Like he was a man of few words, and it was, you had to learn to be very observant. So I had to learn to observe what, you know, I was kind of afraid of him because he was, you know, he was an old guy and he kind of scared me. He was a little daunting. But I respected him. I had a lot of respect for him. I really liked him. I kind of wanted to know what he was thinking without asking him.
Mm.
So I started picking up things that he would do, his repeated things that he might do, or I was looking at the nonverbal communication. Absolutely.
It's interesting to think about how that evolved throughout the course of your life experiences and through your professional training into an intervention that focuses a lot on the nonverbal.
Right. I think it's so important.
Hmm. Are there any favorite or life-changing resources that you want to share with listeners?
Well, I think that I would encourage people. There are so many good information out there, and certainly easily accessible for anybody using the internet. So that's also great. But I think it's important to become more and more educated about the nonverbal world. And that we have some really good teachers on that topic. So I'll include people, for instance, Bruce Perry comes to mind. And he's easy to research on the internet. Bessel van der Kolk, The Body Keeps the Score, which he had a book, but an earlier article. I still think that's a really good thing to read. There's another professional. His name's Bob Scare, And I actually spoke to him not too long ago. He is a neurologist by training, but he wrote a book called The Body Bears the Burden. And he's really been somebody who's focused on the impact of trauma on the body, and he's written a lot about it. So he's a good reference to look up. And the other thing that's kind of interesting, the work by James Pennebaker comes to mind, who is a researcher who, now we were talking about the nonverbal, but he's researched journal writing as a nonverbal expression.
Huh.
And how healing that is. In fact, he's studied it extensively. So that's actually, writing in a journal without talking is also a nonverbal way to express yourself. So for those people who get worried about thinking that they're going to have to be creative if they don't feel like they have the skills, and we know mm-hmm. that, and we know that you can have the skills even if you don't think you do.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many others, but that's just some that come to mind.
Okay. And for those who are interested in learning more about your work with trauma or narrative therapy, where should they start?
Well, they can go to learntraumaart.com, www.learntraumaart.com, and they can get some information there. And my contact information is easily available there. Email,
okay,
any way they'd want to reach me is right there.
Great. Is there anything else that you want to share with our audience?
I'm very happy to have people interested in this topic, and I really appreciate your wanting to highlight the creative world and how important it is to helping people with severe stress. It can't be emphasized enough, so I really appreciate you doing it.
Thank you for listening to Real Stories. The resources referenced by today's guest speaker will be included in the episode description. For more information about me, Dr. Megan Corrado, and my work with the Stories Trauma Narrative Intervention, please visit my website, www.storiesguide.com. Also, feel free to follow my Stories social media pages on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Remember that for every story of trauma and adversity, there is always a story of strength and resilience.